folks. Thank you for coming out. Thanks, Bryn, Alexa, for organizing the whole event about dance and ideas. It's really exciting to be a part of it and to get to go with stuff. Come back tomorrow. Ben Camino will be talking, and then he's doing a workshop on Sunday. There's like perpetually cool things happening. And this, if the pictures were happening, I would be showing you a picture right now of horses, beautiful horses standing in a field. The name of this talk is This Is Not a Talk About Horses. And because part of me at this point in my life, all I ever want to do is talk about horses. I'm on a horse kick. And so I was just sort of like trying to keep that at bay to a certain degree, but it will come up. It will come up later. Come in the end. The subtitle is Or Why I Like to Roll Around on the Ground in Philosophical and Cosmological Terms. Because really, that's kind of, for those of you who were at the workshop on Sunday, this week, rolling around on the ground is it's pivotal to the stuff that I'm going to be talking about. I have some anxieties about talking to dancers about bodies, because you guys know so much about these things already. And some of it will be maybe old news or boring news, but hopefully some of the relationships that I'm able or have been looking at between these questions of sensation and being in the body and moments of thinking about those things in history will be interesting. There's two things that are the key elements that I'm interested in paying attention to, which are both kind of things that are not so jazzy, but I think potentially really fruitful. And I say not so jazzy because the first one is about the motion of the sun. The sun has its own orbit, and when I learned that, it blew my mind to explain if the video was working, I press play, and there'd be this cool video from the internet that shows this way that we all are first introduced to with how the sun sits, or like what the cosmos is. The sun is sitting stationary, and the planets go around it in circles. But actually, the sun is moving, and the planets are all keeping up with it, and it has a 250 million year orbit around the center of the galaxy. And just seeing that first video, it was like an appendix to this wacky outsider physicist's seminar. He was like, in order to understand the things that I care about, you need to know that the sun is moving. And I was like, what? Like, it struck me really quite significantly. And haunted me to the point where it sort of now like haunts things that I do. I gave a talk a couple years ago. Same issue, sort of different concerns. It's like now a thing for me. And just it's moving super fast too. It's going 800,000 kilometers an hour. Like these little astronomical details are really kind of amazing. And of course, it's in the context of the galaxy, which is something we'll come back to. And really, like, this is meaningless in terms of astronomy, or like, I shouldn't say meaningless, but it's child's play, right? Like, we're talking about the multiverse and the whatever quantum things and all that kind of stuff. So the fact that the sun moves is old news, and it's not very glamorous as far as astronomy is concerned. But we don't really think about it. And that, to me, gets to be interesting, because it's what's at stake, or what the influence in our subjectivity, or our sense of our imaginary of the cosmos, it's we haven't bothered to include it. So that became interesting to me. Maybe it's because it's hard to represent, you know, like it's super easy to make a mobile for a child with the sun in the middle and all the planets on little circles, it's like done, there's the cosmos. So how do you include this other dimension of motion? And then maybe things change more slowly than, like, in terms of our cosmological imaginary. Maybe we haven't digested it yet, right? Or conversely, things change so fast that we have now so much new information that we haven't been able to digest, that we're like, it doesn't even matter anymore. Or maybe it's percolating through the culture in ways that are different from what I'm looking for. You know, maybe the fact that we have an internet relates to the fact that we understand the universe in this greater scale. That may seem far-fetched, but I think that that's a sort of like dreamy poetic dimension of the implications of paradigm shifts that I think could be super interesting. And the way that I think about that and sort of like thinking that there could be stuff at stake in that, I've been looking at this book, The Poetic Structure of the World, by this French sociologist guy, Fernand Palline, and he's examining the moment of the Copernican Revolution, so the 14th century, 15th century, when they shifted from the Earth-centered model to the Sun-centered model, right? You had 1,500 years where it was all Earth was the center, man was the middle of everything. God was related to the sun, and it was like out there, and the church positioned itself in between man and the sun. And his examination is trying to understand what made it possible for people to start thinking this new thought that the Earth was not the center of the cosmos, but actually the sun was the center of the cosmos. So that's like seems super rich territory to me. Like, how do you get to a point where a massive shift in the way that people think becomes possible? And it's fascinating because it's not actually the science that did it. Because Copernicus was like, hey guys, maybe the sun is the center of the cosmos, 100 years before Kepler started doing the scientific observations that proved that the Earth was not the center of the cosmos. So it was an ideological shift before it was a scientific or material shift. And it was caught up in the political and cultural moment, because the Protestant Reformation was negotiating these terms, and the sun being the god, standing for God, and having the people have access to God. They were like, well, if the sun is in the center and the earth is circling around it, it somehow presented a model that gave the individual access and shifted the church out of this intermediary place. That would be another picture, which is this like Platonic model of the earth, or this cosmos, where you have the earth in the center, and then these spheres, which are supposed to have the planets on them, and somewhere in there is the church, and the sun is on the outside of that, and so you can't get access to God / the sun without going through your priest, right? So the Protestant Reformation is like, you want direct access to God. Everybody should be able to do that. And it may seem like Protestantism, Catholicism now is like all in a pool to us, maybe, unless you're interested in theology. But it's like a really big deal, right? Like that's the beginning of a kind of political autonomy for individuals within this sort of the logic of the Middle Ages. So, hence, this sort of like to tie back to why I think it's interesting to think about the cosmos, right? Because it historically has carried some pretty heavy cultural things. Where am I? Yeah. I was like, so who cares about cosmology anyway? I mean, I think really just this extrapolating from my own reaction to learning that the sun moves, like just the fact that I was blown away, I was like, okay, maybe this is worth thinking about. And then thinking and sort of reflecting on that for this, it seems like it's kind of a sort of basic instance of thinking about our place in things and what those things are in a way that might be sort of neutral and that allows there to be abstraction or that is an abstraction, right?
Does that make sense?
The one thing I didn't say at the beginning was when I say things that don't make any sense, interrupt me and be like, I don't understand what you're talking about. So that's the sort of general introduction to why I like to talk about the cosmos. To get more specific about it, I love the scale that it introduces. Because when you start talking about the galaxy, you shift your relationship, right? So if we're in a cosmological situation where there's a sun in the center and then there's us, it's like a pretty small zone, right? It's like the sun is shining on us, we're here. But if you open up, like pull focus so that it's the sun and then us and then 400 billion other stars in the soup, our sort of significance in relationship to everything else is like drops and we become something much more modest, which is really, I think, a healthy thing for humans. And we could get a little bit modest. It'd be awesome. Not that we are individually not modest, but somehow on the planet we're not modest. You know what I mean? So this thing about scale, and then that tips into, I watched these VEDU lectures on the European Graduate School YouTube channel about the infinite, which are awesome. I highly recommend them. The Cole's notes of those are, he's like, and looks at these two different relationships to the infinite. One, which is the classical conception, so classical Greece. And basically at that point, you wanted, like, perfection was being awesome inside the existing framework. You weren't supposed to extend beyond what already existed. You're supposed to be really good, but within the parameters that have been presented to you. Going beyond those, hubris, maybe we were reading Macbeth in high school and like vaulting hubris destroyed Macbeth, right? So this is this kind of thinking about a sort of a classical relationship to the infinite. Romantic relationship to the infinite embraces it as the site of new possibility. And so the difference between those two things is the classical notion is basically conservative, right? It's like you're not supposed to do beyond what has been proposed for you. Like, you know, be good at things, but don't change the way they are fundamentally. And the romantics are like, change the way things are fundamentally, which is fantastic. And sort of begins to start to tie back to some of the other things that I talked about, but I don't even remember what they are right now. But and it's interesting to sort of like this being something about text, because specifically the romantics' interest in poetry was trying to find ways of pushing on the edges of what language can do, language being this structure that we exist inside of. Yeah. Yeah, so going beyond limits is really nice. So another aspect of the cosmological imaginary that I'm into is that it introduces all this motion. Right? It's like, okay, so this Earth is going around, but then it's also moving, and the sun is also moving, and like all of a sudden there's all this shifting motion. emotion in relationship. Positions are constantly negotiating is not the right word, but reorienting. Things are changing in relationship to each other. And this, I thought, was a super nice metaphor, and the body will come into this, it's coming now. But this notion of things perpetually being in motion, because your body, even the still body, is moving, right? Like you can't really, like dancers are like this, I learned this from dancers, really. Like there's no, when you try to stand still, there's no such thing. But then even beyond that, right? Like we all have hearts that are beating, lungs that are collapsing and expanding, diaphragms that are moving. And if you close your eyes and tune into those sensations, and I'm gonna say, like, go ahead and try it. 1, 2, 3, watch you guys in the world. Because there's this huge world of sensation that is with us all the time, that we just sort of tune out because we're busy dealing with our lives, right? And being in the world. And that's a sort of dimension of this metaphor of the galaxy or the galactic imaginary that I think is really exciting. And this, like, just as a little bit of an aside, there's Christopher House, who is a dancer from Toronto, was here in the summer, and he gave a workshop, and he's drawing on Deborah Hay, and one of the exercises that he gave us to do was try to sense every single one of the cells in your body and what it is independently doing, and how does that generate movement in your body. And I was like, you don't even know, you are my man. Like, I was so excited because he was basically proposing an exercise that embodied this kind of experience. And it's like, there was a Joseph Campbell book called the, Inner Space, Outer Space, or something like this. So it's a thing that people are talking about as a thing of a sort of a concern, the micro, right? Or this as a model of a much, much, much larger, this being the body, is a model for this ginormous thing. Some people say the universe. I'm good with the galaxy. Like, I think actually the universe is like so huge, it's maybe beyond us to grasp it. I don't need that. I'm working with the galaxy for now. So our bodies, because I think it's interesting that in general we sort of like, we don't think about them very much. I mean, in this, the dancers here are like, well, I think about my body all the time. But, like, for the most part, we deal with our bodies when they are painful or breaking down, or like we're seeking pleasure or we're trying to get them to be better than they are. But just the sort of like day-to-day experience in the body is something that kind of often we tune out. The nature of our culture sort of precludes sensitivity to it. But it's also a historical, ideological thing. Like, since Plato, the transcendence of the soul, and then that getting taken up by the Christian belief, like, all of these, this trajectory, Descartes, the separation of the mind and the body, and the mind has always been, like, people say it's cooler. It's been subjugated, right? And I know I'm talking about a Western tradition, like I recognize that I'm talking about a specific kind of issue, but that's like until I was, 20 years old, that's all of the information that was available to me, and I find, I guess that's the dominant, maybe not anymore, like I don't know what's, like things are changing, but I think it's worth excavating that predominant model, because it's still like the way most of medicine works is informed by those issues, right? Sort of mechanical approach to the human body. So a really another thing that, or sort of like a counterpoint to that, that I have been looking at, which is a super refreshing alternative to this Judeo-Christian attitude to the body, is the Epicurean approach to the body. And Epicurus was a philosopher in the 3rd and 4th century BC. And his position was that the highest good was the pursuit of pleasure and the reduction of pain. Not in a super hedonistic, like, hedonistic or Dionysian, like it wasn't excessive, because he also was concerned with ethics and discipline, like it was all kind of in the service of a balanced and good life. And yeah, discipline, ethical behavior. Also, he believed the human soul was mortal. So they're like part of the reason that he was like, pursue pleasure in this life, because you don't have anywhere to go afterwards. Like, you're going to die. And that kind of, that thread of intellectual history, I think, is really cool. I was reading this in this book called The Swerve. It's fantastic. It's this guy, Stephen Greenblatt. It's actually focuses on the story of a scribe in the 13th century who was a manuscript hunter who found this text that had Epicurus ideas in it. But one of the things that he points to in that book, which sort of fits into my thinking about all of these things, is like, what happened from this, like, Greco-Roman, not like being in the body, to the Christian, like, medieval ideas of people walking around flagellating themselves, right? And it was this mixture of beliefs, like the Christian idea of original sin and the body being intrinsically sinful is really bad news for our being in relationship to our bodies, right? Being willing or interested in being connected to them. So that all desires and pleasures of the body were a vice. And the illustration of this is the story of Saint Benedict, who tells the story of walking down the path, I guess, and having the thought of a woman and it being horrified that this should happen in his mind, and throwing himself in a pile of brambles so that the pain of the suffering, like this physical pain, would extinguish the sin in his mind of having thought of a woman. It's like, okay, this, like, it's super crazy. But like this, I think, is this intellectual history of how we ended up in a situation where our bodies are, for the most part, fairly alien to us. Like, you have to do actively work to get in touch with what is going on. Like, it doesn't come otherwise. You have to sort of that effort. At least that's been my experience, or sort of what I've noticed. And definitely I've noticed that people like are, it's like the far end of the spectrum. They're like, come roll around on the floor with me, and people are like, no thanks. that's cool, but I'm not gonna do it. Again, like, there's a lot of dancers here, you guys are exceptions, but I come from visual art, and it's like, that's brainland. Like, people love it, and this is something I sort of got lost in the writing of the talk, but I spent years looking at, like, body-oriented theory in art, like, oh, let's talk about Rabelais and all of this medieval excessive bodiliness, and Kiki Smith, and Julia Kristeva, and body, 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 and I was like, but this world is talking about it. right? I was like thinking about the body all the time. Okay, it's time to do in it. Yeah. So, the next thing is, and I feel like I hope it's okay. I'm just like surfing through this like litany of ideas. Epicurus, got that, okay. Epicurus was an advocate of the practice of epimelia heautou, which is Greek, probably not how you say it, but it means the care of the self. And it's a practice that Foucault started to look at the end of his career. It was a subject of interest because he had identified through his research that the self was the site that power came to operate in the individual. Like we would internalize the structures of power of our cultures and then just like enact them spontaneously because I don't know because, but that's what he understood to be happening. So he wanted to look at this practice that existed from Socrates, so 4th century BC, through to the like 1st, 2nd century AD, or Common Era CE, of the care of the self. So this is this attention to developing who you are. And it's not body oriented, but I find it interesting because it's this sort of gentle engagement with who you are, paying attention. There was this instruction to keep notes on your conversations, on your readings. People would have philosopher guides that they would go visit that they would even pay. Like he makes this joke about seeing this guy who's like shuffling along. He's like, hey, where are you going, buddy? And the guy is like, well, I'm going to see my master, this guy that I pay and I've been seeing for like 20 years. And it's like this sort of, it's kind of like a therapy model, but it's not therapy, it's like a philosophical engagement. And this, like, I'm gonna make the bridge. In conclusion of this also, you can hear him give this amazing lecture on YouTube from, he was in Berkeley in the early 80s, and he gave this lecture about the care of the self. And he concludes, like, what would it look like to have a non-aesthetic, so aestheticism being, like, repressing the body, worldly pleasures, typically for spiritual gain. So he's like, what would it look like to have a non-aesthetic and even anarchic sort of intervention into the self? And this is what I had been looking at and thinking about when Bryn called, trying to put this together, and she's like, what you doing? And I was like, well, I think it would be interesting maybe to talk about this idea of the care of the self through the lens of what would it look like to engage with the body in the same way that you would engage with your ideas. And not necessarily in like a health way, right? But knowing it as opposed to like being fixing it. It's not about a gym body, but like, what are the sensations that we are having all the time? Like, how can we begin to just build a closer relationship to the stuff that's happening in the physical? So that's what's my proposal. I was like, it's kind of like a hack, like a self-hack. Like, how could moving and being in the body, like, be leveraged as a way of hacking this self, the thing that we're like, okay, this is me, and maybe it could stretch, right? So just tap back into these different ideas about the infinite and going beyond what we already know, or like the, there's another, this, let's just start that, the infinite going beyond what we already know. So that's sort of like where I am these days with thinking about the body. It was a sort of prototypical kernel of that was at work when I did Stack of Moves, which is sort of like the thing that is the beginning of my public movement practice, I guess, which happened at the Western Front last fall. And I collaborated with Justine Chambers, and she and I worked on a warm-up that, like, I don't know, a bunch of you guys were there, so it was like extending the range of motion in the most literal, sort of basic way. So, and it, most of the people there were non-dancers. I was a bit strategic and we decided together to not have Justine throw the invitation out to lots of dance people so that there is a sense of comfort or like ease, so and not a distance between people who are like, oh, I totally know how to do this, because though there's that difference, right? And it can be, if you're somebody who's like, hey, this is me, you know, and the person next to you is like, you know, maybe that's freeing, maybe it's not, but I was like, okay, let's just keep it sort of in the zone of an experiment or a new experience, or maybe, who knows, what do I know about the people we met? So range of motion, like with tempo, gravity, speed, all these different kinds of things, and it was really kind of amazing, like, people went through this warm-up, and then we started playing music and just let it go. And it was sort of like, I don't know, spastic, euphoric, sort of surprisingly, I don't know quite what language to use for it. I didn't think about that part. It was really very, I said people came unhinged, which sounds a bit extreme, but it was really fun. And then following that, I started working with Christina Jagger, and we did weekly sessions that sort of brought it, focused it into experimenting with sensation and perceptions, doing the kinds of things that we did last Sunday, for those of you who were here. So. Very simple, slowing down, rolling around, imagery, like this Christopher House thing, like what if all of your cells are going in a different direction, what if your movement is all initiated by your knee, things like that. So just like finding ways of being in our body that were unfamiliar, and really focusing on just being in our bodies for a couple hours a week, which was really fun. There it goes. So, and this, I guess, like, just to reiterate, the thing that I think is really important about all this is that to get us aside or a different way of looking at the body that's totally not about getting something done. Right? It's not about getting fit or healing even, but just to be in sensation. So there's not like this space of not trying to do something. It's not leveraging it for anything but its own self. It's all means. There is no end. And then I guess maybe to sort of turn that on its head, because this is the part where I'm like, okay, now I'm going to talk about horses, so I've like put another picture of horses up. And I have become really, I had the opportunity to do some work with horses last summer, and it was revelatory, and now I'm like reading books and taking more lessons and stuff like that. And the thing that people are focusing on, and this, they call it natural horsemanship, so it's a different way of relating to horse than maybe horses is conventional. So, and the big thing about it is that horses are breeding really your body language and your tone more than they're reading like what you're telling them to do. Well, they'll read what you tell them to do if you're like banging on them and stuff. But the goal with this is to communicate largely with your physical language and tone. So there's leadership workshops that they use horses in, right? They're like doing all kinds of, you know, how everything becomes about, I don't know, leadership and social interaction. But it's like this exciting thing to me to try to begin to think about how I'm communicating with my body, and that this awareness of my body might begin to make that more readily available to me. And then, like, all of this other stuff. Oh, look what I'm doing. Like, just to become more and more aware of it. And then this sensitivity also, because they point to, like, horses are responding to things that you've said to them with your body that you may not even know that you've said to them with your body. And then the same thing is happening between our bodies and our minds. Like, our bodies will tell us things that we don't know that they have told us, and you're like reacting to gut reaction without even being aware of it. So it's like there's a lot of stuff going on, and I'm interested in tuning into it so that I can deal with, even like, I think under stress situations, it becomes particularly important. And they talk about that specifically with horses too, right? They're like good test cases, because they're really big and potentially very, very dangerous, and you have to encounter them if you're choosing to do this. And instead of reacting, like if something goes wrong, like if you're on a horse and the horse freaks out, if you can calm down, you can calm the horse down. But if the horse is freaking out and you freak out, like it's just things go sideways. And then this, like, I wanted to close, I'm just about done. That I went to see Chris Hedges talk the other week. So, did you go see him?
No.
It was so amazing. So Chris Hedges is this American journalist, radical, and like, part of me is, like, the criticisms that come up in my mind of me being like, I'm going to sit here and talk to you guys about feelings for 40 minutes. And part of me feels like it's potentially, like, improving-oriented philosophies have some anxieties about, where this could fall into that category where it's like, oh, we can be better. We can be better. And then that is really not the direction that I want this to sit in. So this is partly why I'm like, is it productive, or maybe it is productive to really think about it as being indifferent or completely neutral. It's useless. Maybe this is like an awesome useless thing, right? But to come back to Chris Hedges, like, he is talking about civil disobedience and how we are as individuals in the society, and that we're going to have to confront some business. I wrote all this stuff down since I was like, I'm not going to be able to articulate it. He's focusing on the political, media, and ultimately corporate complicity of the evacuation of civil liberties and climate change. He was so compelling about the gravity of our situation due to the increasing concentration of wealth and power and the erosion of the legal protections to the freedom and autonomy of individuals, which we, like, go talk to your aunt about Bill C-51. Like, it's terrifying. And I just say your aunt because I'm like, we likely all agree that we don't want our civil liberties to be eroded, but maybe we have family members who are afraid of terrorists. who think that having their civil liberties eroded is okay, that might listen to us. And like the increasing lack of food security. But he also talked about the human imagination, and he talked about standing and he's like being in physically in contest or confrontation with power, whatever that might look like. And I was like, I think that this is helpful to me, at least, this gathering and kind of acumen with my own body, because it's like the part of you that's like, I don't even want to deal with that, I think often comes from your gut. So that, and after seeing him talk, I was like, I basically have to talk about Chris Hedges to every single person that I talk to now, because it was really inspiring. And then just in conclusion, the cool thing that he said, he pointed to the work of some anthropologist who said, there's like a pair of anthropologists, and I'm sorry, I don't have the citation, but that it takes 1 to 5% of a community standing against something to actually affect some kind of change. Like, critical mass is way less than you might think that it is. And I was like, okay, that is really kind of inspiring. So, that's it. The end. Thank you. Comments? Questions? Thoughts? Critiques? Failures?
I was just wondering if you would tell us a bit about your practice and what you like to do and you what you would do in your off time and just in general your practice.
Yeah, it's really miscellaneous. Like this, the stuff that I talked about with that movement thing, that, and then more the weekly movement things, that's the